Hey guys, before we roll into this next episode, I wanted to thank you all for the kind words that you've left on social media and for all of you that you have subscribed and left reviews. Those reviews help me keep this podcast free. And Matthews, one of my sponsors, was gracious enough to give me a bow to give away to one of you fans that has subscribed and left a review. So if you'd like to win a brand new Halon 32 with a 6-inch brace height in a Sitka Elevated 2 camo, all you need to do is subscribe on iTunes and leave me a review, and you'll be entered to win. And I'll be giving away that bow the first week of June to one lucky winner. So thanks again, and enjoy the next episode.
Welcome to another live event. Today we have with us on the phone Joel Turner, and you know, I want to start off by saying I want to thank everybody that's been involved and leaving comments and leaving me reviews on iTunes. We're going to be taking your questions today live, and anybody who's participating is going to be entered into a little separate giveaway just for this podcast. I'm going to be giving away a B-Stinger stabilizer, Pro Hunter, Sport Hunter X. So yeah, just get your questions ready. Start asking away here. We're going to bring Joel on in a second. And because we're recording this live, we're still going to do it as a normal podcast, and it will be available to listen to here shortly. So there we go. Hi, and welcome to Interviews with the Masters, brought to you by the OutdoorInsiders.com, your number one spot for inside information and quality gear. Today we have with us on the phone Joel Turner, and we're going to be taking live calls and live questions via Facebook about anything you think we can answer your question on. So without further ado, Joel, how you doing?
Good, mate. How are you?
I'm awesome, man. Can't complain. Can't complain.
Good.
Hey, Mike, I see that you just joined on there. Can you hear Joel all right?
Hey, Mike.
I think we're good. Awesome. All right. Good deal. Well, just while we get this started, I know a lot of guys know who you are, but just to for those who don't know, why don't you give us a little rundown of about yourself and what you do?
Well, I'm Joel Turner, and I run a business called Iron Mind Hunting. And Iron Mind Hunting is all about getting people in control of their shooting, because there's a lot of folks out there that are in the same boat that I was for a lot of years. And I've developed a system called Control Process Shooting. And it is basically the blueprint on how to control your business under stress. So I've been working on it for a long time, a lifetime, as a matter of fact, and it's having some major impact on the shooting community. So I'm loving it.
Awesome. Well, if you don't know, Joel's also a championship elk hauler. He's a traditional archery shooter, and you train SWAT guys, don't you, too?
Right, yeah, I'm the lead firearms instructor on a SWAT team and a sniper team leader on the same team. So I get to train the SWAT guys a lot, and I get to put them under stress and test their business. So it's pretty cool.
Awesome. Well, I got a question that came across, actually, my first few questions that came across yesterday and this morning through Instagram and through Facebook Messenger here. So my first question, I'm actually going to post it up here real quick. It's an elk hunting question. What would you suggest our listeners, I changed it up here. So what would you suggest the listeners do to score a bull in late archery season, especially if there's like, you know, no calling going on or whatever, or just late season in general, I guess it doesn't have to be archery season, after the rut.
In the late season, you know, like you said, they're not responding to calls at all. So, and the bigger bulls are going to be away from the cows. So it's a matter of food sources, because after those, obviously after those bulls rut, they're depleted and they want the food. So, but they're going to be, you know, they're going to bachelor back up. And so you're just looking for, not necessarily looking for the big herds of elk. You're looking for those secluded pockets where those bulls go to feed. So you're going to be looking for south facing slopes and all of those things as well. So you can call elk in late season, but you have to be very careful with it, because if you, you know, the bulls don't necessarily want anything to do with the cows anymore, but you can do some calf calling in that late season as well. So don't forget that.
It's true. And there's always that maternal and sometimes paternal. I don't know if I see it so much in elk. I know I've seen it in whitetail before, where they actually will respond, and mule deer too. I've done, you know, right after the rut, I've actually inadvertently called in bucks with a distress call.
Right, with fawn bleats. So the same thing can happen with bulls with calf calls. You just have to, you got to kind of test the waters with it, because if you, you know, your first few calls are going to tell you the world. If you do a few calf calls and that piques the interest of that bull and he starts your way, then obviously then you may have that instinct that you've tapped into. But if those bulls don't give a darn about it, then instantly cut that calling off and go into a spot and stalk type of mentality.
Yeah. Now, you hunt some rosies and stuff like that, right? Because you're of where you live.
Yeah, I hunt everything, man. I hunt them all over the West, and I hunt them on the West Coast, and so I'm hunting Rockies and Rosies all over.
Yeah, that's awesome. I'm actually gonna have the guys with Angry Spike on later on today. We're gonna talk a little bit about Roosevelt elk hunting.
Oh yeah, those guys are awesome, but they know their business absolutely.
Yeah. We got another elk hunting question here. I'm going to post that as well. The question is, do you use scent attractants? And if so, which ones? And how come?
For elk or for what species?
Yeah, it was an elk question, but
I don't use any scents for elk because I'm on the move so much. I'm not in a specific place, so.
Right.
And, you know, if that elk can smell those attractants that I'm using, then he can also smell me because I've got the wind wrong. So
right,
you're not going to be able to mask your scent past an elk unless you're doing like the Ozonix backpack or something like that. That would probably work, but I don't spray a bunch of elk pee on myself.
No.
I'm moving too much. So.
I'll play devil's advocate, I guess, here, but do you think, you know, if you make a mistake or if the wind switches up on you, do you think that it actually will give you, you know, maybe just a little bit extra time or something like that if, you know, the wind is to switch on you and you did have some cover scent or elk scent on you?
I've never been able to fool an elk's nose. And I've tried all that stuff. And when that wind switches, it switches. So I don't, no. You know, and when I'm out there bivy hunting for 4 or 5 days, if you put a bunch of elk scent on, you know, that's going to make for some pretty nasty camping.
Pretty nasty, for sure. So, man. I think, let's see, we got another live question here. Let's see. Brett Nordine, I don't know if this is a question, let me read it here. Last year, called in a 6x6 bull for my buddy, using Joel's bull to cow call, 15-yard shot. I drew an early season bull tag, and I'm considering doing a solo hunt. Does Joel sell electronic call package or MP3 files for this, or cow estrus or bull to cow's call? I guess it's a question if you sell your stuff.
Well, can you, I'm reading that question. I don't know, like in Washington, it's not legal to use an electronic caller.
Yeah, Brett's from here.
So is it legal in Arizona?
Well, in Arizona.
I'm asking, is it legal in Arizona?
It's legal here.
So, I mean, you can take any recording almost from any bull that you've cow called in, and you'll have the bull call and cow's bugle. If Brett wants to contact me, we can talk about some sounds and stuff, but they're not difficult sounds to make. And if he's got a solo, if he's going on a solo hunt, that bull call and cow's bugle is going to be his ticket, because, in Arizona, you've got a lot of competition, plus not only from humans, but you have a lot of competition amongst bulls. So, your estrus cow call, you're going to be calling in a bunch of satellite bulls when you're trying to get to that herd bull. So, and that solo, if you're going solo, man, that bull calling cow's bugle is fantastic, because there's no hang-up spot with it. So I would highly recommend that over cow calling.
Got a question from Matt Howell. When do elk abandon wallows at higher elevations, or do you think they continue through to hit them throughout the rut?
Well, early on they're wallowing pretty hard because, they're trying to get their body temperature down and get all that scent and everything spread around. So once they have established their harems, they don't seem to wallow that much. I mean, they'll still go to water, but not so much do a ton of wallowing. So by mid-season, by like the 15th, 16th of September, you see those wallows kind of slow down a bit. So, yeah. But then they kick back up once you get into that second estrus cycle. So around the 25th.
It's definitely, if you've got a trail camera, it's always a good thing to throw one up there and just see, while you're in the mix, what's going on. And if you get an action on it, then you could go sit it or whatever. So we just got a question from Dan Acosta. What's up, Dan? What broadhead do you use for elk? Total arrow weight for hunting and max yardage. So when hunting elk, what do you use?
I shoot a Valkyrie Jagger. I shoot a 300 grain Valkyrie Jagger out of my stick bow. And my total arrow weight's about 550 grains. Okay. My max yardage totally depends on the attitude of the critter, because I'm shooting a stick bow, I can hit what I need to hit out to, 55, 60 yards, but that would, the arrow flight time is so massive with that stick bow at that yardage. My max yardage is 50 yards, but that critter has to be totally relaxed and not knowing I'm there. So that wouldn't be necessarily a call-in situation, because they're kind of wired up. So, but with the bull calling cow's bugle, we're not usually shooting them that far. We're usually shooting within 20 yards. So it's, that broadhead, though, I'm only shooting like 32 foot-pounds of kinetic energy. But when the broadhead is 300 grains and it weighs more than the shaft does, all of the momentum is stored in the head, and you get like the front-wheel drive car effect. And when this thing hits, it pulls the shaft through there. And I've shot through, with my 50-pound recurve, I've shot through the lower portion of scapulas on big, Cascade Roosevelt bulls and got 12 inches of penetration past the scapula. So, it's not a lot of energy, but that broadhead is awesome. So think about that when you're dealing with elk setups. Try to get that momentum in the head. And if you're not shooting 20% FOC, then you're really decreasing your chances of getting through a shoulder blade if you need to.
Yeah. I know on my compound, most of my compound bows that I have set up on, I kind of go for that medium weight. I kind of go for the happy medium between speed and having a heavy arrow. I typically right around 420. I have right about 20, maybe a little less than 20% up front, but I've never had any issues. I shot my bull this year at 80 yards, and I'm shooting a Schwacker 2-inch, 100 grain. and I think my inserts are 75 grains, if I remember right. Did the job. The only animals I've ever lost are the ones that I shot really, really, really bad. So,
right.
You know, catch one in the ass, you're not gonna, typically not going to find that lucky and got a femoral artery or something. But Dan asked you if you preferred a longbow over a recurve, and then I got another question I saw came across from Scott Sellers about the rut.
So as far as longbows or recurves, man, I shoot them all. I shoot longbows, I shoot recurves, I shoot Mongolian bows, I shoot self bows, I shoot compounds, I shoot anything that I shoot right-handed bows, left-handed bows. I shoot them all, man. I don't necessarily prefer one over another. I'm constantly looking for new challenges in archery. So it's like this year I hunted with a recurve, but it was a left-handed recurve shot right-handed with a thumb ring. So that was pretty awesome. And I love that. So
I got to remind myself to build you a PVC pipe bow.
Yeah, there you go.
I want to see if you kill something with one of those. I'm too afraid to take it out of me, but they're pretty damn fast. When I build them like at 50 pounds, they're fast. They shoot really well.
Send me one, buddy. Send me one. I'll whack something with it.
We had a question from Scott Sellers, but the questions pop up and go away so fast on live. It was something about
I'm looking at it right now. I'm looking at it right now. So what conditions put the rut in full swing, and why does it go up and down so rapidly? So the condition that puts the rut in full swing is the first cow in an area that comes into estrus, because as soon as a cow comes into estrus in the area, then they all start to come into estrus, and the scent is in the air, and the bugling changes, right? Those bulls, now the big bulls that are kind of hanging in the back around the 6th, 7th of September, they've been away from those cows, and they're letting the little bulls do all their thing. And then as soon as the smell gets in the air, they come down and take all those cows away. They know none of those cows are going to be in estrus yet, so they let those little bulls do their thing. As soon as the big bulls come in and take the cows, then it's on for everybody. Now it's a big competition.
Yeah.
So September 12th is the national average day. And then once – that's the national average day for the first estrus cycle of a cow elk. So once – that goes away just in the next few days, right? By the 15th, 16th, you start to see the lull. So that's that decrease that he's talking about. And when you see that, the decrease is because those big bulls know that there's very few cows left, and they're just searching for those last few. And now you start to see cows by themselves. You see these bigger bulls that have broke off and are searching. And then once that smell completely goes away by the 20th, 21st, then it's back to normal. Those bulls break off, and then they wait again. And here they, you know, they'll wait till the 1st of October, 21-day estrus cycle, and here they come again.
Yep, absolutely. Yeah, it's pretty simple to say. I mean, that goes for rut with any animal. It's based on the number of females that are in estrus. And as opposed to what the intensity is going to be like. Everybody likes to think about weather and everything else. Weather has a lot to do with how much they're on their feet, maybe, or how much movement you're going to see. Which question from Brandon Brooks about that? How's temperature playing the rut? Yeah, it's you know, when it's hot, yeah, it's just like anybody else. You don't want to be out running around when it's hot. And exerting yourself when it's hot, but the same goes for elk. You know, when it's colder, they need to be feeding more because they need to be putting more calories on to produce enough heat to stay warm. And you know, when you get that really good weather, then it's just like us, when we get a really nice day, you want to be outside, you want to, you know, be on your feet chasing chicks around, whatever. So that's basically how the temperature and weather affect, in my opinion. So that goes for any animal, deer, antelope.
Yeah, when it's hot, you'll just see more activity at night. So you'll need to be out there locating bulls earlier. you know, like 2-3 in the morning, and then you're going to be, they're going to be going to bed sooner. So you, that's your time to strike is when they actually go to bed. So got to be, you know, you're, when you ghost those bulls in the morning, you're, you slip in the dark within a few hundred yards of them, and then they're going to move at first light. They're going to move to the bedding area. So you just get the wind right, slip in behind them, and when they stop to go to bed, you know, they've taken you to their bedroom. And that is when you slip in tight on those cows and do the bull calling cows bugle.
Yep.
Yeah, I'd say when they're not as active, I feel like you need to be more proactive. Be kind of.
Yeah.
Instead of being reactive, you know, reacting to calling and reacting to chasing bugles or whatever, you gotta be more on search mode.
Yep.
And if you're an area that you can glass, great, then, you know. You know, put some work behind the binos and find them bedded up for sure. And then
yep.
Like you slip in and try to make something happen. I was on a hunt, this past season. One of the guys that, fills in the cameraman is a good friend of mine, Jake. He had an early season tag, and it was in unit 21, which is basically desert. It's, you know, high desert. It's hot. It was hot. And, you know, you had maybe an hour in the morning, and that was it. Everything shut down. They all went to bed. So it's just, like we said, they don't like to move around when it's hot. They're big, big animals, and, you know, they're built to conserve energy. So.
Hey, John, Brandon sent in a question a while back that says, what's the best way to get the bulls to commit to a call? I know they're responding less to bugles because so many are being used nowadays.
Okay.
And I'd like to address that because, you know, there are a lot of people that are bugling, but that's just it. They're just bugling. They're bugling the human bugle, which is the normal low to high, three chuckles at the end. And if you if that's what you have in your toolkit, you are significantly decreasing your odds. So if people are just out there bugling, if you chuckle, you are talking to the bull. And that is, in my opinion, not the way to be doing business. You don't hear people walking around doing bull calling cows bugle.
No.
You know, you just don't hear that. So yes, people are bugling, but they're not bugling in a way that should affect how you do your business. So, you know, you are hunting the cows. When it's in the rut, you're hunting those cows, you're slipping in tight, and you're doing a short, raspy bugle that has no chuckles. That is the way to do business. I mean, I can't stress it enough. 35 herd bulls in the last 5 years to that one sound. And I'm not walking around the woods just blowing a human bugle, right? I'm calling with purpose. And sure, there's going to be people out there bugling away. And that bull might bugle back to him, but he's not coming into them.
Right.
So, you know, they might try the setup, but that bull's going to move away from those people that are doing that. So follow him. And when those people abandon it, you know exactly how you're going to go do your business.
Right, absolutely. And we talked about that in our other podcast that we did together. Jason just posted up here, said, great info on hunting during the rut. Any helpful tips for late season rifle hunts? And we kind of touched on this a little bit probably before we jumped on. You know, we talked about, you know, switching more to a spot and stalk type game. And, and we also talked about a little bit about incorporating other calls. You know, they may not be bugling. They actually may be bugling. So, you know, a lot of times you'll still see, at least here in Arizona, I've never hunted in anywhere else other than here. So I don't know. I've hunted rut in other states, but I've never, ever gone for a late season hunt out of state. I know on my late season, I've had two late season archery tags, and I've scored bulls on both. And both times, the elk were still bugling. They weren't answering the bugles. You couldn't bugle, and they'll bugle back to you. But there was times where they would let out bugles because they were still with cows. You know, there was still some pushing around going on some little bit. And this is in late November. I'm trying to think when my tag was last year. Pretty sure it was the middle of November. It was the middle, mm-hmm. It was about the middle of November, I believe. And the bull that I shot was still bugling. And he was one bull, and he had like 30 cows with him. And the night before we had seen them, there was another three bulls, and they were bugling back and forth to each other. I got in a mix. I didn't do any calling. I let them do their own calling, and I slipped in, and I got in the middle of the herd, and I just didn't have a shot opportunity. All my shot opportunities were like 90 yards plus, so I just eased out of there, slipped out of there while I was still, had a little bit of light, backed out of there. We went back there the next morning. We glassed them up, same thing, slipped in there, let them do their thing, and got a shot opportunity. So I think it becomes more like hunting deer for me. But I don't have anything to offer you when, if you're hunting, especially if you're hunting like in Washington or Oregon, where it's super thick and you really can't do a whole lot of glassing unless you're looking at, clear cuts and stuff. You got anything to?
Yeah, that's the name of the game for rifle hunting in Washington and Oregon and stuff. Is if you're doing those late season rifle hunts when they're not bugling and there's a lot of people in the woods, you're just basically looking for the thickest patch of cover that you can. Try to stay on south facing slopes and get those glasses out. Glass those units that when I say a unit, I mean logged off areas that you can get on the other ridge, and you might be a mile away. So good glass is a big deal, even in a thick country. So, and then, have a rifle system that you can shoot quite a ways yeah. with. And because when you get over there, you can't see them. So you may have to shoot them from where you are or your side of the ridge. So, you're, long-range rifles are becoming kind of the norm in this in all areas of the West. So,
mm-hmm. Yeah. Jason just posted that he's in 3A, 3C. Well, that's a real classable unit, actually. I just go to your deer hunting tactics, go check those burns. There's a lot of big burns that you can glass. They'll be in there. And if you could get somebody and get a good set of radios, because we're allowed to use radios here in Arizona, if you don't want to take super long shots and have somebody talk you in, it's not too hard, in my opinion, to get within 200 yards of an elk. I mean, you should be able to get into a nice, comfortable zone and make it happen. So, Scott just chimed in again. So my late bull hunt, the bulls were grouped back together. Yeah, so it was a late rifle, December 4th. Yeah. Typically, right about that time is when they start getting back together. I agree. So, I had a question come across yesterday. Let me see if I can find it now. About blacktail deer hunting. How do you typically hunt blacktail? You stand hunt them or?
Well, I used to still hunt them, and I would creep through these nice timber patches and stuff, and I had limited success with that. And then I started hunting them out of tree stands, and blacktails are almost unpatternable, so it was difficult to just put a stand up somewhere. I mean, you can find pinch points and stuff like that, like the whitetail folks do, but the blacktails, I mean, you're going to spend a lot of time in the stand not seeing anything. So I started actually hunting them in the rifle season here in Washington, and which gives us the last week of October. And that is when I have found to be, the ultimate time between October 22nd to October 31st. That pre-rut is pretty phenomenal. And then I hunted them over bait in both Washington and Oregon, and that's I really like doing that, just because you can actually see these critters come in and you can interact with them, and they're close. And blacktails mm-hmm. are so much like ghosts, it's really cool to see them. But in hunting them over bait, I learned why I never killed any still hunting. Because,
right.
You know, I would sit in a blind and with an Ozonics machine going and all that stuff going on to try to fool their nose, and they would, you know, my buddy who set the stand up would come in and get me. He wouldn't allow me to get out of the stand, right, so I didn't burn his stand. And so he would come and get me, and he would text me when he was at a certain point up the ridge. And mm-hmm. It was 500 yards away, and these deer would – he's making no sound, no wind, and these deer would detect him. I mean, he's basically walking into their bedroom, right? And they would just – they wouldn't run. They would just – fade off into the timber. I watched it time and time again, and I've seen it in other stands as well now, and it's very, very difficult to still hunt for blacktail, and I have a tough time myself moving slow enough. I mean, there are people that consistently kill big blacktail bucks, and when you talk to those people, they move extremely slow. And they stop, you know, every couple of steps and wait and wait and wait. They don't cover a lot of ground, but they kill big bucks. So it's very interesting how they get it done.
Cool. Let's see what we got. R.L. Grant. One thing you see every year is guys posting up cam pics of bulls in June, July, and August. And then all of a sudden the season gets here. They struggle to find them again as they move to the cows. Do you see the same thing?
I see that all the time. You know, people have got – they've got these bulls on camera, and there's no cows on the camera. I would much rather see cows on the camera than bulls because yep. They're going to come together. And it's not that the cows are going to move to where the bulls are. The bulls are going to move to where the cows are. So in your summer scouting, you need to find the cows. I don't care if I don't see any bulls in my summer scouting. If I'm where the cows are – that's where the bulls are going to be. So much more important to find the summer range of the cows than it is the bulls.
Yeah, I think if you're trying to keep tabs on bulls, this actually goes into a question that I'm going to ask you after this that we got sent over. If you're going to keep tabs on bulls, you better have one of those seasons that starts in like late August or, you know, even that first week of September where they really haven't quite started. They're still kind of in their little bull home range. It's just like
right.
Joel said. And this applies to the deer as well. When I scout for whitetail, when I scout for mule deer, I look for does. If I'm going to hunt the rut, I look for does. Let me back up. If I'm going to hunt early season hunt, whether or not, then that's a different story. But if I keep tabs on where all the does are at, where all the cows are at, because I know if I'm going to hunt that area in the rut, that's where those boys are going to be. They're going to be there because that's what they're interested in that time of year. So, you know, getting velvet bulls on cameras, you know, way up high in some basin or, you know, in some thick timber and stuff like that, they're going to abandon those areas. And really, you know, what you should be looking for is the cows. And, you know, even after the season, go back and look where all the rubs are at, look where all the rutting sign is, and those are good areas to apply your efforts to when the rut comes around because they'll reuse those same areas. So the question that we got last night was, what's your plan for scouting and how do you locate and keep tabs on big bulls?
So I just look for cows. I kind of know what is potentially in the area just from shed hunting and or bulls that I've seen in years past. But, you know, some of these places I hunt, I've never, ever been in before. Like, you know, we went to an area in Idaho, never been there before. And what I do when I am on a blind hunt like that, I just hike to the top of the highest mountain I can find, and I blow my bugle. I do a location bugle off of that, and I glass off of that. So scouting for me is sometimes fairly limited. If it's local areas, you know, I'm just looking for cows. But
yeah.
if it's some place that I can't just drive to, then, you know, I'm going to – I'm going to just get there, look at the terrain, look at the water features and the south and north facing slopes, and I'm going to hike to the top of the mountain and blow that bugle. And my goal when I step into some place I've never been before is to get a bull to bugle within the first half hour. And that seems to be pretty good.
Awesome. Well, you know, and I think part of the thing is you and I aren't not that we don't like to shoot big stuff, but I don't think we're quote unquote necessarily trophy hunters. Where in the sense that we don't go look for that one bull and stick to that one bull, and so I don't have a whole lot of experience. Like I've done it with whitetail, and I've done it with mule deer. But as far as elk are concerned, I don't feel like I've shot enough of them to, like, be picky and choosy. I'm just looking for a mature bull. So never really, I don't know. You never just pinpoint, you know, try to pinpoint one bull and stick with that guy from.
Well, you know, I'm doing that more and more now. I mean, I've killed quite a few bulls and I'm trying to get after some bigger bulls, but I don't usually find those until I'm there. You know, it's not like I'm able to spend the whole summer with this thing and map out its movements. So when I get there and I'm working my location bugles, when I find that one that's, you know, the big growler or whatever, then I'll start to figure him out. And it's not difficult to get these bulls because you're going to tap right into their instincts. So, you know, you'll know that bull from his bugle, and you just got to be careful with your time to strike. Hunt the situation, not the bull, right? He's got to be in a certain situation, meaning he's got to have cows, you know, and you get them right before they go to bed, and it's fairly easy to call those big boys in.
Cool. William Tillman just invited us to go pigeon hunting with him.
Well, that's cool. I love killing pigeons.
I've never done it. That sounds like fun. I've done some bird hunting with my longbow before. That'd be fun. Do a little, get some blue lizards.
Yeah.
So, Stephen asked, how much bugling do you do? Do you just locate, or do you pressure them and get them angry enough to come kick your butt?
I do a lot of location bugling just to find them, and then once I find them, then it's a very specific plan. I mean, once they locate, I get closer, I do a relocation cow call, they try to call me in with a bull calling cows bugle, that tells me that they've got cows, and then I just slip in and hunt those cows, get close to cows, do a bull calling cows bugle. I mean, that is my go-to thing, and it works every time you get the situation right, every time you get close enough to the cows. I've never had it not work. So,
Brandon asked, when you say bigger growler, are bigger bulls the ones with the raspy bugles?
Well, the bigger bulls are usually raspier, not because of age, but because of intensity. Mm-hmm. So when they are protecting cows and stuff and they're challenging other bulls, they usually go over pressure, and you know, when they go over pressure, that's when you get the rasp, and you'll hear the intensity of it. But I've also had big bulls, when they try to call me in if I'm cow calling for some reason, you know, do these little tiny search bugles or these little wimpy bull calling cows bugles because they're trying to be quiet about it. They don't want to seem to let anybody know that they're trying to get to that cow. So it's difficult to judge how big a bull is by his bugle, but you can know that if it's very intense and very raspy, it's probably a mature bull.
Yeah, it's a rule of thumb. I mean, typically little bulls don't make big bugles.
Right.
You know, but you got to be careful because big bulls can make little wimpy sounding bugles.
Absolutely.
It's just like rubs too. I get that question all the time about rubs. Little bucks don't make big rubs, but big bucks do make little rubs. And the same thing with elk, same thing with bulls, although it's not necessarily as much, because I feel like big bulls usually beat the crap out of trees and tear apart that they're broken. But
right.
We got a question from Abel, actually two. He asked, when should you use a cow decoy and when should you use cow calling?
Cow calling, I only use cow calling when the bull, when it's a satellite bull situation. So I'm not trying to cow call a herd bull out of a herd, because if there's cows present, they are going to take their bull away. They are not going to let him go play with the hussy in the bushes. So cow calling near cows is almost a sure bet for disaster. They know exactly what everybody sounds like, and if you're a foreign female that wants to procreate with their man, not going to work out so good. So that's the deal with cow calling. I would only use it if I do a location bugle, that bull bugles back, and then I move in closer, and if I do a relocation cow call and he's starting my way after I cow call, then he doesn't have cows and he's a satellite bull. Thing is, when you're cow calling, is you have to set up for the hang-up spot, right? You have to set the calling location first. Wherever you're standing is the calling location. You have to look out in front of you and find out where the hang-up spots are. Where is that bull going to be able to see this calling location?
Mm-hmm.
Do your series of cow calls, and then you have to move, or you have to move your shooter past those hang-up spots, because you're only trying to call a bull to a hang-up spot, not past the hang-up spot. So, and if you're by yourself, when should you use a cow decoy? Well, you can certainly use it in that situation. If you've cow called and that bull is starting your way, and he's probably going to be doing bull calling cows bugles, which would be short, raspy, no chuckles. If he's doing those to you and he's moving your direction, pop that decoy up, give him something to look at. But certainly you need to still move past the hang-up spot. Because he's going to stop, and that decoy may pull him past it, but I'm not into the business of getting lucky, right? I want to totally work on their instincts. Their instinct is going to be to stop at a certain point when they can see that decoy. So set that decoy up in an advantageous place where, you know, he may put himself up on a knoll where you get a good shot from several different angles or whatever, but he's going to stop. So be very, very careful with it, but just don't cow call near cows. It's not a good strategy.
I agree. It's never worked for me.
Yeah.
Never worked. I try to call as little bit as possible, really. I try to let them do all the calling. Use that as a Geiger meter to give me, you know, a water stick to get to where I need to go.
It's about calling with purpose. Don't just be blowing a call to be blowing a call. You know, call with purpose. Have a strategy behind your business, and your calling success will skyrocket when you do that.
Yeah, absolutely. Actually, we got a question last night. I wasn't going to bring it up, but it was actually a deer question. It said, you've been successful calling in deer. Have you ever, and I've tried everything, what do you do to get them to come in? And, you know, I was going to answer this. My answer is, you said call with purpose. I'm going to elaborate on that and create the illusion. So I'm going to use rattling, for instance. Okay. Guys always, I'm up there rattling my antlers or I'm whatever. That's one piece of the puzzle. You know, if you create the whole illusion that there's actually two bucks fighting or two bulls fighting for that matter, we're talking about elk right now. If you're down on the ground and you're stomping sticks and breaking, you know, making a ruckus, so two bucks or two bulls would be making, you've already added another effect to your call. You know, a lot of times I'll start, I'm going to go back to white-tailed deer just because this is easier for me to talk about real quick. It's like I'll start with, an estrus bleat, and then a buck tending grunt and then go into my fighting sequence. And if I'm stand hunting, for instance, I'll tie a rope to a branch down below me so I can move that up and down and make it sound like there's two animals moving around. And I've done the same thing while elk calling, you know, breaking trees, breaking, you know, branches and whatnot, and then going into a rattling sequence with, you know, some bull grunts and whatnot. And it's just creating the whole illusion because they know that when they hear that sound, they hear that rattler, the antlers rattling together, they should be hearing something else. And it just depends on how aggressive that animal is at the time, whether he gives a crap or not, that he's not hearing the rest. So sometimes you get lucky. But if you really want to be successful all the time, you got to create the whole picture. You got to paint the whole picture for him. So.
Right. And in elk calling, you know, let's say you go into an area, you know there's a bull there. You know he's there. You know he's got cows. You do a location bugle, and maybe for some reason you were too close, and he does not locate back to you. You know he's there. So one of the big things that I do, if I know there's a bull there, I'll just break a big branch, right? Pow, break that one big branch, and that might get him to bugle. If that doesn't get him to bugle, then you need to create that illusion that you're talking about, John, and I do a breeding scene, right? So estrus cow calls to start, and then tending bugles and glunking and thrashing around, breaking limbs, all kinds of stuff, where this bull is chasing a cow. That bull that you're after is not the subject of your calling. You're just creating a breeding scene, and you're going to create that jealousy instinct in that big bull that's down in that bottom somewhere, and he's going to pipe off to that. You're not a threat to him, but you're up there getting some business, and he's not, right? So he will bugle to that. That's no threat to him. That's no threat to his cows. These two elk are up here doing business. He's not. So he's going to bugle, and that is your time to listen. Okay, he bugled. You might want to do it again so that he is locating. He'll start to locate himself over and over and over again. Simple business. You know he's a herd bull. You know your strategy. Go down. Now that he's locating himself, slip in on his cows. Bull calling cows bugle. It's a phenomenal strategy.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I'm definitely don't call myself an elk hunting expert, but I've noticed over the years that there's certain things that work in other type of hunting or other species that you hunt, and you just take that same formula and you keep applying it across the board. And calling, I mean, goes everywhere from turkey calling to predator calling. It's making sure you're the most believable that you can be. And you put it simply, but, you know, call with purpose and have and paint in the picture. I think it's if you want to call in animals, that's you need to learn to do that. So
yeah, you know, it's not that you need to know so much about animals. We are mammals as well. So look inside the human behavior that you see. I mean, you can learn everything you need to know about calling in critters by going to the bar. Literally. You can go there and watch a bar fight, and you'll see and really dissect the dynamics of what just happened there. And you'll see everything you need to know. You'll see the initial challenges. You'll see the reactions of the females. You'll see the reactions of the males and what utterances they're making. And it's just you would take that and apply it to elk calling, to deer calling, to whatever. And that's how it works. I mean, everything's out there for the proliferation of their own species. So
Absolutely.
It's really just look inside and you'll see it, man.
Absolutely. Just got a question about hunting muleys in the rut. I'm gonna field this one for you. Actually, almost all my big bucks were killed that way, RL. He was asking about have I ever used basically fawn in distress. All my big mule deer are either killed in one of two methods, either spot and ambush, which is a modified spot and stalk, or that I've spotted them, made a move on them, and called them in to shooting distance with the fawn in distress. It's very effective, but if it's done wrong and it's not the right situation, you're going to send deer running. It has to be very, very, very specific. Does it work? Especially, okay, if I'll take desert mule deer. There's a certain formula that I look for. I have to be able to get to a spot where I can set a trap, so to speak, a funnel, where I know that, and I use an FX3 or a Fox Pro when I do this when I'm by myself. But this would work if you're mouth calling and you had somebody calling for you, is to be able to set that call behind you in a manner that they have to come past you. And it's hard for me to explain it verbally. I can paint the picture for you. Actually, I probably have a couple videos on YouTube if you jump on there. I do the same thing with my predator call because I archery hunt predator. I don't usually use rifle or firearm. So the setup is key. And another thing that people don't understand or don't or haven't maybe realized is that if there's not a certain amount of deer there, my formula is if there's not at least five does with one buck, they're probably not going to come. You might get lucky and they may come, but if there's more than five, they typically, safety in numbers, they feel like, okay, the more deer there are, typically the better chance you have of pulling the lead doe out, and she's going to come running. The buck's going to be in tow behind the doe that's in estrus at that point. Hopefully it's the lead doe. So you also got to think in your head that if, let's say there's 10 does and one buck and one like little spike buck with their group, if you got to be able to fit all 10 of those does in your section past you for that buck, just in case he's the last one. Otherwise, you might get all these does come running in. They're going to either pick you up or they're going to stop when they can see to where the call is coming from. That's the same hang-up spot that Joel was talking about with the elk. There's a hang-up spot. But once they get to a spot where they feel that they can see or that they should be able to see where that call is coming from, they're going to hang up. They're not going to keep on coming. So you got to keep all that stuff in mind. And if you're going to use that tactic, because I know a lot of guys that are running around out there, especially here in Arizona, because they've heard that that works, and they're just willy-nilly going out there. And all you're doing is educating deer, and they're not going to come, and it's going to screw it up for everybody else. And then I'm not going to shoot big bucks anymore because you're learning my tactic. but no, really, honestly, if there's not at least five does and you can't get to a spot where you're able to pull them past you to make that shot, I wouldn't use it. Because either they're going to get to a spot and you're just going to get frustrated, not going to be able to get a shot off, or you're just going to educate them. Or worse off, you're not, they're just going to turn tail and run, and then you had no opportunity at all. So I might write an article about it here or try to do a video of it. You kind of show an ideal setup. That way, we're not educating all these deer out here. So hopefully that answered your question.
Yeah, that's good info.
A few questions came across, but I missed them because I was too busy rambling on here. I see one from Jason. Transitioning from rifle to bow hunting, would you recommend buying brand new, brand name used, or work through the curve, or just to bite the bullet and purchase a new high quality bow, or any, you know what my take on it is, and from my own experience, I'm going to use binoculars, for instance. Okay. When I first started hunting out here in the West 26 years ago, you know, I bought whatever I could afford. I started, and might not be in this exact order, but I started with a pair of, you know, Bushnells, and then, you know, my buddies had already had Saguaros or whatever, and I was like, oh, I got to get a better set, and then I went to the Nikons, and then I went to Zeiss, and I had a pair of Fujinons, and I ultimately ended up buying the Saguaros anyway. And the same thing goes for, I feel, with any equipment, you get what you pay for. And it's just smarter to stick through another season right now, what you got, and save, so that next season you can afford to buy the best of the best. One, it's going to last you a heck of a lot longer. Tolerances are always tighter. You know, there's a lot to say, you said about confidence. You know, I know in the compound world, I mean, I shoot Matthews, and I have for years and years, because it's a quality bow. It's always a quality bow. There's been models that I didn't love, but they've always produced a quality bow, and it was always repeatable, and it always had my back. So, yes, I guess I would say, you know, start with whatever you got now, or stay with whatever you got now, save up, and then buy the best that you can, you know, you could afford, and go from there. What's your thoughts on that, Joel?
Well, I approach it a little bit differently, as far as, you know, they've been making good bows for a long time. But these bow companies go through transitions or technology. You know, there'll be a new technology that will come out, like a string dampener, or, you know, the string dampener that comes out of the bow, or whatever it may be, a new cam system or whatever. So there are certain years of bows in all bow companies that were good, and there are years where they were stuck, where there wasn't any new technology, and they were trying to just put extra crap on there, right, that didn't really do that much. So if you're going to look at used bows, just be careful of those years, and you'll see when a new technology came out, everybody's following that technology, and it's pretty darn good stuff. You know, I mean, you can go back to 2006, 2007 and find some phenomenal bows for very, very cheap that are really good, and then you'll have a few years there where maybe that cam design that everybody was trying to chase wasn't so good, and then now you're, you know, these modern bows, when I say modern, I say a couple years old, like 2015 and forward. There's a lot of really good models out there, and you can get a very, very good shooting bow for way cheaper than you can a brand new bow. So, and that brand new bow, if it's in one of these technology gaps, may not be as good as that one from a couple of years ago. So you got to kind of listen to those people that buy new bows every year, and they'll certainly tell you, oh, that was my favorite model. And if they can give you an explanation as to why that was their favorite model, I guarantee you can go on a website. You know, there's lots of them out there, eBay, Archery Talk, any of those, and you can find that model, you know. And so listen to the people that buy bows quite often, and you'll get some better advice on when was the years of these technology gaps. And so, I mean, I purchase bows for people all the time that are trying to get into it, but I know when those technology gaps were. So I'm looking for very specific models that I have personal experience with, that I know were that solid bow that had my back, like you're talking about, John. So you don't have to go super, super expensive. But, you know, the technologies that are out in the last couple years, phenomenal stuff. So just, and I look at Bose from a simplicity standpoint as far as the string system goes. Is it a string system that's easy for somebody to replace in the field or replicate? Or is it something that I'm on a backcountry hunt somewhere and I'm going to have to go to a bow shop that might be, you know, way, way away and to get my bow fixed? Or is it something I can handle myself? And so that's another way I look at these things. So, you know, there's a lot to be said about shootability, but there's also a lot to be said about simplicity. So that's kind of how I look at it.
Yeah, that's good information. I personally wouldn't even try to do it out in the field, but that's just me. Unless it's my longbow, I have no problem whipping up a Flemish tree or something. But I don't know. I don't know that I would try to replace my string or trust that I did a good job.
I've had to do it on a lot of people's bows in the woods, so it's you know, I take a kit with me to be able to do all those things. But
yeah, Rick just mentioned that Native American people hunted with hickory bows. That I get it too, man. But you know, and Joel and I understand that because we both like to shoot traditional. I don't really hunt often with traditional because I don't trust my skills, but they also lived and breathed hunting. It was part of their life, and they had a bow in their hand every day, all day long. So it was just every much a part of them. So, you know, when you're talking about a guy that gets to go on two hunts a year or a weekend warrior or even myself, I hunt 100 days out of the year. You know, it's still not, I'm not living with a bow in my hand. So I want whatever technology is available to me. I want the best of what I can have to be out there. You know, cause I don't like to leave. If I can control it, I like to control it. Basically, there's so much stuff about hunting that's uncontrollable, if I can minimize my risk by having something that's better and more reliable, I'm definitely going to go that route. So,
John, there was a question that came in yesterday about, you know, me training police recruits on balance balls and how do you get your reticle to not move as much, or what is the purpose of that training? And I'd like to address that if I could.
Yeah, sure, absolutely.
So basically, when I have somebody stand on a balance ball or, you know, shoot from the push-up position on one arm or whatever it may be, I put them in an unstable position. The reason that I do that is not to make them more steady. The reason I do that is for them to give the aim away, to give it to the subconscious, because you have no physical control over your aim. It is completely run through visual proprioception, which is the visual feedback system that moves your muscles and corrects those movements. So when somebody's standing on a balance ball trying to shoot, they are seeing their sight go all over the place. I need them to give that up and just let it dance. And then what the purpose of that training is that even though they're seeing all of that shot, all of that sight movement, they are able to bring themselves back to the trigger press and really concentrate on that movement, because no matter how much they're moving, if they stay with the concentration on the trigger press and they evaluate the pressure increase until that shot breaks as a surprise, you would be extremely surprised at how accurate you can be even in vastly unstable positions. So that's right. The purpose of that training is to get people to realize that they need to trust their sight and trust their eyes. Watch the spot that you want to hit through that scope, not the reticle. If you're watching the reticle, You're only getting fleeting glimpses of what you want to hit. If you're watching the spot you want to hit, you've given the reticle an anchor point to always come back to, no matter how unstable the structure is. So you're watching that system, and you're concentrating on the trigger press. So that's the purpose of that training. And once I get people to that point where they trust their eyes and trust their sight, they become a much more effective, not only tactical operator, but a hunting operator as well. So that's what I'm doing when I do that type of training.
Makes sense. All right, guys. Well, we're going to wrap it up, but before we do, I want to give away this bee stinger here. And I don't have any sophisticated way of picking somebody. So, Joel, why don't you run through the list of people that have been commenting and interacting and pick a guy.
Pick a guy. Holy mackerel.
I didn't really. I don't think we had any emails on there today. Well, but at least not that asked questions. So
let's do Mr. Brooks, Mr. Brandon Brooks.
All
he's
right.
Been fairly, he's been engaged in this whole thing.
All right. Congrats, Brandon. You are just send me a PM with your address, and I'll get that shipped out to you. All right. Well, that's all we got for you today. Does anybody else have any other quick questions before we close this up? Brandon said thank you. Good info. All right, that's it. So, you got any really good hunts planned yet for this year? Did you draw any tags yet?
I haven't drawn any tags yet. I'm in for New Mexico, but I didn't get Wyoming, so I'm probably going to be hunting Idaho and hopefully New Mexico. It depends on if I don't get New Mexico, then I'll be probably Oregon and Idaho. So,
awesome. I may try to get to Oregon. I drew a Wyoming tag.
Oh, very good.
Same unit I had like 7 years ago. So,
cool.
Should be a good hunt.
Yeah, hopefully. Absolutely. Oh, it will be.
Yeah, good.
Yeah,
good.
For sure.
Yeah, but I do want to try to get to Oregon. I want to go. I want to shoot a Rosie bed.
Oh yeah.
I had some opportunities. Almost a little over 10 years ago now in Washington, and I didn't know any better. Basically, I passed on bulls that I shouldn't have. And that was my first time hunting.
Don't want to pass up to me in Washington, bro.
I didn't know that you shot 230-inch 5x5. So
yeah,
but hey, you live and you learn. But I had a good time. Glad you came on, and I'm sure we'll talk soon. And I want to thank everybody for taking the time to sit down on. What did Justin say? No info on Rosie's. You know what, Justin? I'm gonna have Angry Spike guys on later today, not live, but we're gonna do a podcast with them all on Rosie's. So be sure to listen for that one. That'll come out, and you'll get all that information. So, but
that'll be a good one for sure.
Yeah, those guys know what they're doing. Absolutely. Yep. All right. Well, thanks a bunch, and we'll catch you guys on the next one.
All right. Thanks for having me, John.
Absolutely.